Welcome to the inaugural podcast of San Francisco State's series of faculty discussions and interviews. My name is Eva Shepherd-Wolf, and I'm here interviewing my colleague, fellow historian Christopher Waldrop. Professor Waldrop has recently published his nth book, one of many, and this one is Jury Discrimination, the Supreme Court, Public Opinion, and a Grassroots Fight for Racial Equality in Mississippi. The book is published by the University of Georgia Press and is part of their series in the Studies in the Legal History of the South. Chris, how did you get the idea for this book? Where did it first come from?
Completely by accident. I was actually researching a different book on the Civil War in Vicksburg, and as part of that research, I was reading the newspapers for Vicksburg from 1883 to the Civil War, to World War II. And in 1907, when I was reading the newspapers for 1907, I came across an article saying that there were African Americans serving on the juries in that county, Warren County, which stopped me cold. I mean, that's impossible. There can't be black people on the juries in Mississippi, of all places, or maybe any place, in 1907. That's called the nadir of race relations in America. That's segregation is completely solid at that time. White people are very comfortable in their discrimination and their prejudice and their racism. They feel entitled to it. They have entitlements, they think. So this just, obviously the white jurors were protesting. That was the subject of the article in the newspaper. So I just had to figure out how this happened, why it happened, what was going on. So it was trying to get an explanation for that anomaly that launched this project.
And to get an explanation for that, you had to go back all the way to the Civil War, and you had to reach as high as the Supreme Court, as well as to the local story. Can you briefly describe how it was that P.C. Downs and other African-American men did serve on juries very briefly in Mississippi in 1907?
I found that there were two parts to the story. First off, the reason black people were on the juries in Warren County, Mississippi, was because of the work of a lawyer named Thomas Dabney Marshall. Everybody called him Dabney Marshall. So I had to figure out who he was and why he would want to do that. He was a white man, descended from the John Marshall family of Supreme Court fame. They migrated out of Virginia across the South, and some of them came to Mississippi. And he had an amazing story to tell. This was a fun book to research. I hope it's a fun book to read. But it was like one startling thing after another I found as I was researching him, his life especially. But also the other question, which is what was the law like that allowed him to do that, put him in a situation where he could challenge the discriminators, the deputy sheriffs and the sheriffs who picked the juries at that time.
Well, let's start with Dabney Marshall and then move out, because he is a curious figure. He was a poet, he was a writer, and he went to jail for killing somebody in a duel.
Yes.
And you argue that and he was accused of being a homosexual, which
yes.
is why he entered this duel.
Yes.
And you suggest that it was that, the duel and the resulting prison term, because it was illegal.
Yes.
Even though it was culturally
approved
to kill people in duels,
yep.
that made him even more of an outsider and allowed him to challenge the white racist system.
Yes, he was probably always an odd fellow. He was born in 1860 in Vicksburg. His mother was a champion gardener, and he was a champion gardener. So there was sort of probably an effeminate quality in his life from the beginning. Also, he was just a lot smarter than everybody else. They would comment on this. He was elected to the legislature, so he probably felt he had a position of privilege because of his family, whatever wealth they had. I don't think they were the wealthiest people around, but they had a plantation, maybe more than one plantation. I'm sure they hired black laborers to do the farming for them. I'm sure they didn't dirty their hands with this. On the other hand, his family was also Unionist family. They had opposed secession. His uncle went to the secession convention and stubbornly refused to vote for secession, even as other people were falling away and being seduced by the crowd that was attending the convention and shouting at them from the galleries and so forth. They were stubbornly nonconformist. He was in favor of prohibition in a town that was famous for its brothels and its alcohol. It's sort of a wash in alcohol, and here he is the champion of prohibition, mm-hmm. which shows that he has an amazing confidence in the power of the Constitution to shape people's behavior. Misplaced confidence, no doubt, but nonetheless, what it tells us about him is he really believed in the Constitution. And yes, he was in the legislature, he was running for re-election, and rumors circulated, which the newspapers refused to say, but we know that they were saying he was homosexual. He was a gold Democrat. In fact, he was kind of like, he would be considered a conservative. The silver Democrats were these liberals, you know, William Jennings Bryan and so forth, and they were the ones that were circulating the rumor as a way of destroying his career. And in that society, in that culture, if someone circulates a very ugly rumor designed to attack your prestige, your reputation, you really are compelled to confront them with a gun. And he felt that. He was so blind that he could barely see the person he was supposed to shoot.
Apparently a good shot anyway.
Well, I think they were probably closer than you and I are. And he had two cousins that went with him to stand on each side of him to make sure he was facing the right way. I think, you know, in a longer version of the manuscript that didn't get published, I explored the shooting in much greater detail. And it may have been kind of an ambush. I don't know that he really gave the other guy a fair chance. I think he was terrified of him, frankly. I think Dinkins, the person he shot, was quite familiar with firearms and was a very masculine kind of fellow. And he was a 90-pound, very nearsighted person who was very smart, very charismatic, but not a champion of the masculine arts of fighting and shooting and so forth. So I don't know that he gave Dinkins a fair chance to shoot at him before he shot him, quite frankly. But it didn't matter. I mean, I think most white people in Mississippi understood it as an affair of honor. It's like a duel, if not an actual duel. He had the good fortune of getting the next governor as his lawyer, but then the governor felt like he couldn't pardon his client. So he had to wait for the next governor to pardon him. So he spent 6 years in prison for something that he didn't feel. And I do have, there aren't very many Dabney Marshall letters, but he did write letters from prison that are preserved. And he did say, I feel like what I did was required by the culture. I don't feel wrong exactly what I did, even though he also produced letters that he reclaimed that he did feel bad about going against the law for someone who believed in the law as much as he did. And after he gets out of prison, he's representing black people right and left. I mean, of course, the newspaper was his friend, his ally, his champion. They published favorable stories about him before he was involved in the shooting. While he was in prison, they still wrote one or two articles saying what a swell fellow he was. And after he was out and he was representing African Americans, they still were on his side, even though it was a kind of paternalistic racism, I think, that the newspaper was promoting. I don't think they would be, not as non-discriminatory as we in the 21st century might think mm-hmm. they should be. But nonetheless, for that time, it's pretty amazing what John Cashman, who's the editor of the paper, actually did. So, according to the newspaper, you would think he only represented black people. I don't know if that's true, but those were the articles that got in the paper. And he, one of his clients was kicked by a police officer, so he sued the police officer. Another one of his clients was put in what they called the sweat box, which was a small wooden crate they put African American prisoners in. They put blankets on top of it in Mississippi in the summertime. You can imagine how horrible that would be.
It would be a sweat box.
That would be a sweat box. And he got the police chief on the witness stand and started cross-examining him. And all we have is the transcript, so we don't know the gestures, the looks, all the body language, all that's lost to us, unfortunately. But the police chief begins by saying, "So you have a sweat box?" And the police chief says, "Well, we call it a sweat box. It's a box." And so, and you can almost see the judge waking up in his seat saying, "You have what?"
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not supposed to admit, at least, that you're coercing confessions. Mississippi, in fact, has a long history of not permitting coerced confessions. Even in the slavery era, slaves were not supposed to be coerced into confessing. I think there may be true that in some way slaves had better representation and better due process than free people did after the Civil War.
Well, they had owners. Slaves had owners who cared about keeping them alive in a way that free people after the Civil War didn't always. They didn't have owners anymore.
Absolutely true, but you know, when a slave was accused of murdering his master, they still got the whole panoply of representation full exposure to all the due process you would expect to get for a white person in circuit court. I've said many times that black people could get full due process of law as long as they committed murder, rape, and arson. Anything else, any kind of theft, and they really got the short end of the stick. But for those death penalty cases, they got the best lawyers in the state. They got the ability to confront witnesses. They got considerable due process. Their due process rights were protected by the Mississippi High Court of Errors and Appeals, which was in the name of the Supreme Court of Mississippi at that time. And this was these rules that they made in the slavery era were published in books that continued after the slavery era ended. So they were not supposed to be coercing confessions from people, even if they did it.
And that brings us to a number of different questions that you explore in the book. When you mentioned Dabney Marshall as a prohibitionist and his belief in the Constitution, that points us to the consideration of the larger legal world that Dabney Marshall and other people had to operate in. And then you've just spoken about Mississippi law and the way in which Mississippi law, perhaps surprisingly to people unfamiliar with it, did protect African-American rights to some extent. How did those two levels interact to bring black people onto juries very briefly? What happened on the level of the Constitution, which Dabney Marshall so believed in, and the Supreme Court, and what happened in Mississippi to allow this brief moment of black jury participation?
Right. I had a lot of fun researching that. I studied the Supreme Court to find out what rulings they had made about juries. And the most important rulings came in 1880 and 1881, mostly in 1880. There were three in March of 1880, all decided on the same day, and then one sort of follow-up case in 1881. After I had explored those cases as best I could, I then went back and looked at the Congress to find out how they wrote the 14th Amendment, how they wrote the laws, and in fact, they wrote laws against discrimination on juries, as a matter of fact. It's still federal law today as a result of the Civil Rights Act of 1875. I think people forget about that aspect of the Civil Rights Act of 1875. And then I wanted to look at the sort of popular culture about juries. People, you can say that a jury of your peers is a fairy tale, that minorities and despised groups in America very rarely get a jury of their peers. Women, of course, very famously did not ever get juries of their peers, really. They would be put on trial for voting illegally, and the jury would be all men who could vote.
Mm-hmm.
So clearly they were not getting a jury of their peers, as Susan B. Anthony said and found out in 1873. But nonetheless, there is this idea in the popular culture that we're entitled to a jury of our peers. And I learned a lot from doing this, and one of the things I learned was that's the true meaning of constitutionalism. It's the popular understanding of our foundational principles.
Mm.
And to the extent that the Constitution writes that down and reflects that greater reality, it records the constitutionalism that's in the mentality. And that's probably the reverse of what I would have said a few years ago. I would have said that first you have the Constitution, and then constitutionalism follows that. I don't think that anymore after researching this book and studying this particular issue.
That's sort of ironic, because it was from the top down in some ways that, as Dabney Marshall's working from the bottom up, and his African-American lawyer helper he has this guy, Willis Mollison, helping him.
Mm-hmm.
So they're working from the bottom up, but they couldn't have done it without what the Supreme Court decided from the top down. So you are suggesting that the Supreme Court felt obligated to draw on and to honor a popular fairy tale, for lack of a better term, about a jury of one's peers? Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, and also Congress, and also the people who wrote the Constitution in the first place. People who wrote the Constitution in the first place made a big mistake. They didn't put in protection for civil juries, just criminal juries.
Mm-hmm.
And they found they had to correct that with the Seventh Amendment. So that was a correction of a mistake. So why was it a mistake? It was a mistake because they misread what the public wanted. And the Anti-Federalists were very effective in demanding that that be corrected. So that shows you, I think, that this constitutionalism does percolate from the bottom up. And the Supreme Court's role in this, you're right, the Supreme Court created rules that Dabney Marshall could use to get a small number of African Americans on the juries. if the Supreme Court had done a better job, he could have gotten, and he and many other defense lawyers, could have gotten many more African-Americans on juries. He could not get enough on to matter, really. But if a different set of rules in 1880 would have, or could have, in theory, created a environment where defense lawyers felt as comfortable as they had been before the Civil War to challenge all-white juries. Now, the argument against that, of course, is that the Supreme Court was reading public opinion, and if they had tried to do more, they wouldn't have worked. But we don't know that. That's a counterfactual. We do know they put some pretty severe limits on what defense lawyers could do.
Because some aspects of the Supreme Court decisions from the 1880s, the jury cases, still affect cases about jury, jury discrimination or accusations of jury discrimination today. Could you talk a little bit about what the Supreme Court did lay out, what guidelines it established in 1880
yes.
and 81?
Yes. There were three cases in 1880, one in 1881. The easiest one was a West Virginia case, Strouder versus West Virginia. That was easy for them because West Virginia actually had a law requiring that all juries be made up of white men, I think, over the age of 21. So that was written into the law of the state. There was no way that any defendant could expect the state to correct what the state's lawmakers had done. So the Supreme Court brushed that aside. That's unconstitutional. You can't do that.
You can't limit a jury by law to white people.
Right. You cannot do it. The second case that probably almost as easy came out of Delaware, and that's Newell versus Delaware. In that case, Delaware at that time, I don't know what the law in Delaware is now, but at that time, Delaware only had five judges in the entire state, and they would simply, those five would come together and be the Supreme Court. So they were the same judges that were the trial court judges would simply come together and review what they had done as trial court judges. They had a lot of funny systems in different states at that
time.
Seems
like a bit of a conflict of interest.
Yeah, New York had an interesting system too, but that's not the question. In Delaware, the most senior judge was considered to be the Chief Justice, and that was a man named Comegys. And he said in a written opinion of the court that black people are so clearly inferior to white people that it's not surprising that only white people get picked to be on juries, because that's as it should be. And John Marshall Harlan wrote the opinion in that case, and he once again brushed that aside. You cannot say, it's outrageous to say in the highest decision of the judiciary in that state, from which there is no appeal except to federal courts, that black people simply can't be jurors. So the rule that the Supreme Court makes basically is if a state is foolish enough to confess their discrimination, they will get slapped down by the Supreme Court.
You can't write it into law.
That's right. So the trick is to discriminate without saying you're discriminating. And that was a very effective device, which basically was created by the Supreme Court that lasted, some would say, to the present day, because we still have very often all-white juries, even in America right now, even after rulings against that by the Supreme Court, and the modern Supreme Court has struck that down and ruled against it. But you still have low-ranking people who pick juries who discriminate. And the trick is how to get those low-ranking people to conform to the national ideal.
And in the climax of the book, where Dabney Marshall, along with his co-worker, Willis Mollison, does get Mississippi officials to confess to that discrimination.
Yes.
The working together of Willis Mollison and Dabney Marshall seems to be really important. Can you talk a bit about Willis Mollison, who was a very unusual figure also, a black lawyer at a time when there weren't very many black lawyers at all, a person who really believed in the dignity of African Americans and believed that he could change people's minds by showing how dignified and well-behaved and intelligent African-American people could be.
Yeah, I wish I had letters passing back and forth between Dabney Marshall and Willis Mollison, but those don't exist. But clearly they were working as a team, even if you can't find the paper trail, because Willis Mollison went to the Board of Supervisors and demanded that they have black jurors.
And this is in Warren County, Mississippi.
Warren County, yes, exactly, and early in the 20th century. And they, of course, rebuffed him. He published a book celebrating sort of an encyclopedia of great black people living in Warren County. He's very much in the Booker T. Washington school of protest, where you prove you're worthy to be treated equally. Some people find that offensive, but at the time it may have been, he certainly, it was his way, whether we like it or don't like it, that was his way of protesting. He did not like boycotts and sort of street protests, which did take place even in 1904 in Mississippi and even in 1880s Mississippi. He didn't approve of that. He thought the better way to protest, he would rather be on juries than boycotting streetcars.
Right, and in fact, he suggested people stop boycotting streetcars when they were boycotting streetcars.
Yep.
In the 1880s, was that?
1904. The first Mississippi passed two segregation laws. The first one was in the 1880s. And it's a curious thing in the American constitutional system that it worked this way, but they actually discriminated first, or segregated first, interstate transportation, trains that went across state lines. That should have been the second thing they did.
Yeah.
But they did it first, and I think they were encouraged by the Supreme Court in Munn versus Illinois, which is a case involving grain elevators. You'd think it has nothing to do with whatsoever with race and segregation, and most people think it doesn't, but right after that case was decided, Mississippi said, oh, if Illinois is allowed to regulate grain elevators, even though the grain is going across state lines, we can regulate train cars going across state lines. So they did it first in response to the Supreme Court. And the legislature appropriated money to pay the lawyers that they knew they were going to need to defend what they did.
Wow.
The second case, the second law was in 1904, and that was actually the city trolley cars and things like that. You'd think that would have come first. In 1904, the newspaper said, we know there will be a boycott because there was one 20 years ago.
Hmm.
It will blow over. Don't worry about it. When I saw that, I went back to the 1880s and furiously searched because I wanted to find those boycotts. They're not in the white press. They were too fearful in the 1880s of African-American people to report their protests and their boycotts. By 1904, they could report the boycott comfortable that they didn't have anything to fear from it.
So the techniques, to move on to a digression for just a minute, the techniques that African-Americans employed so successfully in the civil rights movement, starting especially in the 50s, starting to some extent in the 40s, but especially in the 1950s, had a much longer history than we usually think.
Absolutely.
But Willis Mollison was not somebody who supported that form of protest. He wanted to go through the courts.
Yep.
And attack jury discrimination. Mm-hmm. So we don't know, because the paper trail isn't there, how he hooked up with Dabney Marshall. But what are your guesses based on all of the records you did read? Do you have any suspicions?
I think it's in some ways pretty obvious. Willis Mollison was he owned his own newspaper. He had a bank. I mean, he was a very active person in the city of Vicksburg. He was a lawyer. He teamed up with a lot of white lawyers. He used their law libraries. He writes about it. I should say his son interviewed him and wrote about it. So he had a lot of contacts. So suddenly Dabney Marshall gets out of prison. He starts representing African-American people. He starts attacking the Jim Crow system. Of course Willis Mollison is going to take notice of this and link up with him.
Mm-hmm.
And Dabney Marshall will call Willis Mollison as one of his witnesses in the hearing that is at the climax of the book. You know, are there black people that are qualified to be on juries? And, of course, Willis Mollison will be glad to testify there certainly are.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows them, and he can name them by name, and he knows they're well-educated people that have been relied on by the county government in cases of floods and, you know, epidemics and things of this nature. So clearly they were working together. And the fact that Willis Mollison protests before the Board of Supervisors, and the next thing you know, Dabney Marshall is his sort of front man. I really think Willis Mollison was the brains behind this whole thing, and that Dabney Marshall was simply the guy who needed to cross-examine white officials, that he could not comfortably do that.
Yeah, Willis
or
Mollison.
Safely.
Right. Willis Mollison, as a black man, even though he was an established lawyer and civic leader
right. Among
African Americans, could not cross-examine white people, and certainly not white bailiffs or police.
Right.
But Dabney Marshall could. And so Dabney Marshall did, and he was very clever about it. And the book, you do a wonderful job in the book bringing this courtroom drama to life. So short of reading from the book, or rather instead of reading from the book, could you tell us a little bit about that climactic moment when Dabney Marshall had to, because he was abiding by the Supreme Court's rulings, get officials to admit that they were discriminating even though that wasn't written into law, and find a way to get them to say it,
right. Because
they had to say it. They had to somehow
right.
say that they were discriminating. The absence of black people on juries was not in itself evidence of discrimination according to the law at the time. So how did he succeed in getting people to admit it in court?
Well, through dogged cross-examination. I found the transcripts. I looked up every transcript that I could find from any court case that was appealed to the Mississippi Supreme Court where Danny Marshall or Willis Mollison were attorneys of record. And I had a hard time finding any Willis Mollison cases where Willis Mollison is the one who's actually, his voice is being heard, even though his name is on the case. So he was not someone who confronted people in court very often, even though his name was actually on more cases than Dabney Marshall. He took more cases to the Mississippi Supreme Court than Dabney Marshall did. But that's my source, is the transcript that was sent out to the Mississippi Supreme Court. And he called Willis Mollison. He called the sheriff. The sheriff fended him off by saying, "I don't pictures. I don't have anything to do with it. I have deputies that do that. Well, what instructions do you give your deputies?" "I don't give them any instructions whatsoever. I don't say anything." So the sheriff weaseled out that way. He called the circuit clerk, who testified that there were, in fact, black people in Warren County who had paid their poll taxes, who were literate and who were qualified to be, who were voting, in fact, although not very many of them were voting, but some were voting, and they were certainly qualified to be on juries. Not very many, but some. And they went name by name. He brought his big book into court, so there were some. And then he brings in T.C. Childs, who was the deputy who actually picked the jury. They were using a, people are sometimes amazed to hear this because we don't do this anymore, but in those days, if the people whose name were on the jury list, who got the letter in the mail saying we were calling you for jury duty, if they ran out of those folks, which they very often did, they would send the deputies out into the street to pick people up who just happened to be hanging around the courthouse. And there are stories of people hanging around the courthouse because they needed a job. They would get like a dollar or so to be on the jury, and so they would hang around the courthouse hoping to get picked for jury duty. So T.C. Childs literally was the person who went around saying, you will be on the jury. And he knew enough or had been briefed by the prosecutor that you shouldn't admit this because he was trying to avoid admitting anything. And Dabney Marshall was, once again, we don't have their voices. We don't know how loud he was or how soft he was, but clearly he was dogged and determined. He kept asking the same question over and over again in different ways. He kept saying, "Be fair with me, now be fair with me," over and over again. And I think T.C. Childs finally got a little annoyed that this 90-pound, nearsighted guy was just hammering away at him, and he finally just erupted and said, "Well, it's settled with me. I never pick a black person to be on a jury." And, of course, he pounces on that. You know, so it's the policy of this court not to pick black people as jurors. Everybody knew that was the policy of the court. Everybody in Mississippi, if not the nation, if not the world, knew that that was the policy of the court. But the Supreme Court had set up this weird situation. You had to get somebody to say that that's what they were doing in order for the jury to be struck down. And as soon as he made the confession, voices erupted all over that courtroom. The judge interrupted, the prosecutor interrupted, Dabney Marshall's co-counsel interrupted. They're all trying to get this guy to back away from it. Dabney Marshall's not trying to get him to back away from it. His co-counsel, they were trying to get him to say that other people were working with him. Mm-hmm. The sheriff had helped you. They know, "Oh, no, it was just me, all me." He took it all on himself. But he did make the admission. And Dabney Marshall wrote in his brief, "The cat is out of the bag." So I think I have to assume, or we can assume, that as he was walking out of that courtroom today, that's what he was thinking. The cat is out of the bag.
I got him.
I got him.
But he didn't get him for long. So it was after, was it right after that, that they started allowing black people onto juries in Warren County?
Oh,
when
no.
exactly did it happen?
No. They went ahead and had the trial with an all-white jury, even after the submission goes into the record. And even though the judge is clearly worried about this. There's a conviction. Joseph Hill is convicted of murder. Joseph Hill did commit murder. We shouldn't forget that he was a murderer. He shot a woman with a shotgun.
So just to clarify, this whole debate over with T.C. Childs over whether blacks are allowed on juries was as part of a challenge to the picking of the jury on a murder case,
yes.
In which a black person had been accused of murdering a white woman. Right?
No, I think she was a black woman.
A black woman, okay.
Yeah, she was, like I said, she was shelling pecans when he shot her. Anyway, so that the trial went ahead, and there was a conviction. He was sentenced to death. And Danny Marshall appeals to the Mississippi Supreme Court. He submits briefs to the Mississippi Supreme Court. The member of the Mississippi Supreme Court who was the leading expert on criminal law wrote the decision in the case, and that guy happens to have been the same person who represented Dabney Marshall when Dabney Marshall was on trial himself for murder. He'd been moving out of the bar up to the Supreme Court. So that's a weird kind of coincidence.
Well, it's a small society.
And a small state, relatively speaking, or thinly populated. Took Calhoun a year to write the opinion, even though it was two paragraphs, very brief opinion. Clearly, he did not want to rule in favor of Dabney Marshall, did not want to throw out the conviction of this obviously guilty person, but he couldn't figure out any way around it. He did not rule that blacks had to serve on the jury. That's important to remember. It's a pretty weaselly, wishy-washy kind of opinion. What he says is the judge made a mistake in not allowing Dabney Marshall to challenge the array of the grand jury. Mm-hmm. The hearing that we've been talking about was a challenge to the trial jury. Under the law of Mississippi, you were not, in fact, not allowed to challenge a grand jury or any jury once it was sworn and seated,
mm-hmm.
which didn't make any sense, really, because you wouldn't challenge a grand jury until you had a reason to challenge the grand jury.
Which would be after they were sworn and seated,
accusing you of a crime. And certainly, if you were a black person locked up in a small cell with no lawyer, because Dabney Marshall was appointed as his court-appointed counsel, only at arraignment, so he had been indicted long before. So it didn't make any sense, and the Mississippi Supreme Court did not want to throw out that rule. They had sustained that rule in two recent cases involving white defendants, but this time they felt like they had no choice, so they did rule in favor of Dabney Marshall, although not the way he wanted. They didn't say you have to have black people on the jury. What happened was that John Cashman, the editor of the Vicksburg Evening Post, publicized this opinion. And in fact, his interpretation of the opinion, in some ways, is more important than the opinion.
And this gets back to your point about popular understanding of rights
yes.
being the source of rights.
That's right.
That it was the white newspaper editor and his interpretation of what the Mississippi Supreme Court did that, in fact, affected what happened next.
Yes, that's exactly right. He said there have to be black people on juries. If there are not black people on juries, we're going to have African-American murderers and rapists turn loose on society. We can't. That's a horrible thing. We can't have that.
Because their convictions will be overturned.
Every defense lawyer in the country will be attacking our juries and winning.
Mm-hmm.
So the Board of Supervisors read the paper more than they read the opinion, apparently, and started putting a small number of African-Americans on the juries of Mississippi. A year after that, the Mississippi Supreme Court handed down another decision in another murder case where another defense attorney had tried to use the Dabney Marshall approach and specifically said you don't have to have blacks on juries. You just have to not discriminate while you're picking your juries. And in that, they were exactly replicating what the Supreme Court had said. They were not challenging the Supreme Court. They were simply reflecting what the Supreme Court had ruled. The Supreme Court said you can have all white juries for decades. And as long as nobody confesses to the discrimination, you don't have a problem. So the word went out, obviously, shut up. Stop. If you're going to discriminate, don't ever admit it. And we go back, things are back on track from the white perspective. You can have all white juries once again.
And at what point did things change? At what point was a confession no longer required to prove discrimination?
Well, the Supreme Court ruled against this jury discrimination again in a case called Batson. And the tragedy of the Batson decision is that there's been recent studies by the ACLU and other groups showing that, in fact, the same thing is still continuing, that white local officials are still tending to pick. And what's happening is that the prosecutors are challenging black people who turn up for jury duty. So black people are in the jury pool now. But they're being thrown off juries by white attorneys at a much greater rate than is justified. So we still have the same problem of jury discrimination that we had in the time of Dabney Marshall and Mississippi. But it is true that it's not quite so blatant as it used to be in the Supreme Court after the Batson decision.
And when was that?
I think it's the 1980s, but I'd have to look to be absolutely sure about that. But for many years, it's been unconstitutional for prosecutors to pick off black people in the jury pool just because they're black. But that ruling has not been very effectively enforced.
And it's hard to prove. It's hard to prove why somebody is being excluded.
Yeah, but if you vigorously try, you can do it. We need more Dabney Marshalls, I guess, mm-hmm. to just rigorously go after this kind of thing. And I think you can do it. You'd have to cross-examine in some ways the discrimination is shifted from the people who are picking the members of the jury pool to the prosecutors who are prosecuting the cases. So that's the change, I mm-hmm. suppose. And the prosecutors, all too often, are picking off people because of their color. And if you cross-examine them about this, I think you could expose that. It just doesn't happen very often. We don't do that.
And prosecutors are pretty savvy about the law and what they're supposed to say. So
sure.
you'd have to be at least as clever as they are to catch
them
in it. So for you, it seems that what's more remarkable is that there were black people on juries in Vicksburg, Mississippi, in 1907 at all.
That's right.
That occurred.
That's right.
But one could look at it and say, well, that was an odd sort of blip, and you have these extreme, extraordinary personalities, mm-hmm. Dabney Marshall, Willis Mollison, and the white newspaper editor, John Cashman. And what's really more important is how quickly it was shut down and how broadly accepted it was that black people should not serve on juries in the United States. So what makes you think it's important to notice this odd event that was not long-lived?
That's all true. For me, it's important because tracing this story out taught me a lot about how the system works. And I think people reading the book will learn a lot about how the system works.
I did.
And yeah, I mean, it's something that historians have absolutely not studied. There's lots of work on voting discrimination and almost nothing on jury discrimination.
Which is very strange, really, considering how essential the jury process is to our legal system.
I think so.
They always tell you that when you go to jury duty. They remind you how important you are.
And many historians have said that we can explain this result because the jury was all white. But they've never looked into why and how the juries got to be all white, which I think takes us to the bigger point. The Supreme Court, what is the Supreme Court's role in our society? Is it to simply reflect public opinion, to go with what's popular, or is it to stand against public opinion? And any Supreme Court justice who were walking into this room now would say, we have to stand against public opinion. And they would point to heroic justices in the past who've had the courage to do that. But if they were being completely honest, they would admit also another truth, which is that if the Supreme Court stands too much against public opinion, it will lose credibility and lose legitimacy in the eyes of the American public. One of the great jewels of our system is the Supreme Court, in part because we have such great respect for it. The fact that the Supreme Court could virtually pick the president in the year 2000 and people accepted that shows you the power and the prestige of the Supreme Court. This is something that's valuable and must be guarded. And I have read many files by Supreme Court justices and looked at the memos they pass back and forth to each other. And I can tell you that they do think about and talk about the prestige of the court and do worry about how their decisions will affect how people view the court. As well they should. I'm not criticizing them for that. I think it is a valuable legacy for us to guard and protect. But the tension there is that sometimes they need to use that prestige against public opinion. And this was one time when they could have done it. I think in 1880...
And they did a little bit.
They did a little bit.
They said you cannot write into law that you are discriminating against black people in juries.
They did.
You have to do it without saying you're doing it.
That's right.
So that seems to be some kind of middle ground between standing up for the ideal of a jury of one's peers and acknowledging the deeply racist nature of American society in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. So they were sort of doing both. They were going with public opinion and yet holding some kind of thin line against outright racism.
If you read the debates in Congress as well as the debates at the Supreme Court, it's obvious that many American white people wanted the Congress and the Supreme Court to say that it was perfectly okay to pick white people to be on juries. They wanted the discrimination to be you know, they say, what's wrong with black, with white people judging black people? White people are fully qualified to judge black people. You don't need to have black people on juries just because you have a black defendant or a black plaintiff. So they hoped, a segment of the population, we don't know how big a segment, that the Congress and the Supreme Court would actually endorse open discrimination. And that they would not do, to their credit. They refused to do that. The last try at that was in 1900 in a case from Texas, Carter versus Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, I'm reading between the lines here a little bit, but it seems pretty clear to me that Texas was hoping to use this case to get the Supreme Court, this is after Plessy versus Ferguson, take just one more little step and say that it's perfectly okay to openly discriminate. And they thought the Supreme Court might actually endorse that in 1900. And the court still wouldn't do it and really brushed aside that case in a surprisingly short opinion. So they clearly were still, as much of the discrimination as they were willing to tolerate, they would not go that far.
Yeah.
So open discrimination, saying you're discriminating, that's not acceptable. And in fact, the Supreme Court said things that we can quote, you know, golden phrases about how evils of discrimination and how equal rights are important. So they put some language out there that's actually very useful. You can quote and use even now to show the evils of discrimination. The problem was the level of proof they demanded. They put such a heavy burden on defense lawyers that they virtually guaranteed all white juries for decades and decades.
One of the contemporary issues that seems to be very much related to what you studied in this book is something I know you are interested in working on now, which is the gay rights movement. And there's a different kind of alignment between public opinion and the law. It seems to me that it's because public opinion is much less hateful toward gay people that the court has changed its rulings in the last 10 years or so.
I suppose so. I mean, that's really the perfect example, though. I mean, for decades and decades, there has been enormous hostility among a great majority of Americans against gay and lesbian people. And the courts have tolerated that discrimination. And now they're starting to go the other way. And I think but I don't know that public opinion has really quite, it may be in the process of breaking and shifting, but we're in this sort of moment of flux, which may be comparable to 1880, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully we'll see if the courts do a better job than they were able to do in 1880 in ruling in favor of gay and lesbian rights.
I think that's a good place to conclude. Thank you very much, Professor Christopher Waldrop, speaking on your book, Jury Discrimination.
Thank you very much, Eva.